Yeah, we're good to go.
Okay.
So tonight we're going to learn how to live better lives. One of the reasons that people don't live good lives is because they don't have a good attitude. It's not so easy to have a good attitude when things are not going right. So if we could learn how to look at life differently, we would be able to make our good lives a lot better. In order to do this, we're going to take a look at this week's Torah portion, specifically really at one word we're going to zero in on, and we are going to talk about the notion of the Exodus and what brought it about, and how by personalizing this, we can learn how to change our attitudes and live better lives. Point one, be it resolved that the Exodus, the narrative of the second book of the Torah, is not simply a historical event, but rather it's something that reflects the life of each and every single Jew. That is to say that not only on a national level, not only are we born as a people through the course of slavery and persecution, not only does the notion of being in the land of Egypt represent the family of Jacob being planted in the ground and dissolving, as it were, so that a nation can grow, because there needs to be like a huge jump, a gulf. The seed doesn't naturally turn into a tree. If the seed remains a seed, the tree would never emerge. Only when the seed rots or spoils or dissolves is it possible for extraordinary growth to ensue afterwards. But be it resolved that we're not only talking about this broad overarching picture of how the nation of Israel was born, but rather that this narrative, this Exodus narrative, is a very personal one and something that each and every one of us experience, not only broadly speaking, but also specifically speaking. That means the details of the narrative of the Exodus are specifically relevant in our lives today. That's point one. And point two will be, if indeed it is so, how do we see corollary between our lives and between slavery or bondage in Egypt? After all, thank heavens, none of us have ever known the pain, suffering, deprivation of previous generations. We've never been enslaved. What does it mean we have to experience an exodus if we never experienced a golos in that sense? So we have to figure out how to look at the exodus from a different perspective, and that'll be point two. And once we understand how to look at the Exodus from a different perspective, then we will revisit the concept of the plagues which brought Egypt to its knees and allowed the Exodus to unfold. Personalizing this and that will enable us to change our view of the things that happen in life. And when you change your perspective and you see beyond, your good life is going to get a lot better. Okay? That's the trajectory of today's class. Let's go from point one. There is a Mishnah. The Mishnah is found in Masechet Psachim. Now, if you want to talk on a technical level, the Mishnah Masechet Psachim is telling us about how we must observe the Passover holiday. That when we sit around the table on the night of Pesach and we tell our children the story of the Exodus, this shouldn't be a narrative of something that once happened to somebody somewhere. But instead, we should personalize it. That's why the Mishnah says, B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation, chayiv adam lirot et atzmo, a person must see himself, ki'ilo hu yatza mimitzrayim, as if he, or she, you, left the land of Egypt. On a very literal level, had our ancestors not been taken out of Mitzrayim, had God not brought about the great geula, the great redemption, we would never have emerged as a people. We wouldn't have the privilege of being who we are. We are only the Jewish people as we know it because of the events that took place in Egypt thousands of years ago. But the Alter Rebbe maintains that this cannot simply be understood as a technicality, or that somebody should try to personalize or make relevant Jewish history, because otherwise we wouldn't be a people. In the 47th chapter of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, whose Hilula is today, says, V'hine, b'chol dor v'dor, every single generation, and he interprets, this means v'chol yoyim v'yoyim, it means every single day. Because if we are supposed to experience things generationally, when does the generation begin and when does it end? Is it once in a generation? Is it one person in a generation? Is it every person in his or her generation for a moment? Like if this is a relevant concept, if this is something which we're supposed to personalize, then it would have to ultimately be on a daily basis. Because when we have annual events or annual mitzvahs like eating matzah or celebrating Matan Torah or talking about the notion of creation and receiving a new lease on life, the Torah assigns a specific day for that. But here we say b'chol dor v'dor. It doesn't say b'chol Pesach u'Pesach. It doesn't say every Pesach you must see yourself. B'chol dor v'dor means this is a recurring theme. This is eternally relevant in every time and in every place. Now, the Rebbe says if it's relevant in every time and every place, it has to be relevant on a daily basis. That characterizes what defines us, our service to God. So chayav adam liris atzmei, a person has to see himself. Ki'ilu hu yatzei mimitzrayim. What does that mean? How could this be understood on a daily basis? If you're to tell me that on an annual basis when I sit at the Seder, I should try to imagine what life would have been like as a slave. And had God not taken out my ancestors, I would still be there. Or I would still be part of a slave people. We never would have emerged as the nation of Israel with our rich history and our beautiful, glorious pageantry of the last 3,000 years. Okay, amazing. That's not what it says. It says, b'chol dor v'dor. So if it's in every generation, it means the word dor v'dor in English is called relevance. This is relevant. So if it's relevant, it's got to be relevant all the time. What does that mean? What does it mean that the Exodus is relevant all the time? I'm not enslaved. I'm not persecuted. I'm not suffering. Everything's great. I don't feel like I'm in Mitzrayim. I don't feel like I have to leave Mitzrayim. You come to a Jew and say, oh, you live in Canada. You have to move to Israel. I'll say to you, like, with all due respect, I mean, I don't feel like I'm enslaved. I don't feel like I'm having a bad life. And what of all the generations of Jews who didn't move to Israel? They were violating this principle? It doesn't say, b'chol dor v'dor chayav adam ladur ba'aretz. It says, see himself gilu yatzei mimitzrayim. What does it mean then? So the Alter Rebbe says that this is talking about yetzias nefesh or lekis mimasar haguf. This is talking about the soul being liberated from the prison of the body. In other words, who are we? Who are we? When are we a bodily, corporeal reality? So when a person dies, is it dead and finished and gone? Do we believe that? When a loved one goes to their eternal reward, are they finished? Or do we believe the soul lives on? So we are the neshama. We are the soul. If we are a soul, why don't we act like a soul? If that's who I really am, how come I'm not interested in soul or spiritual things? How come we're motivated by material things? If I'm such a soul, if that's who I really am, then why aren't I full of love? And why aren't I full of fervor and passion and selflessness? Because that's what souls are. That's everybody understands what's what a soul is. So why aren't I more of a soul if that's who I really am? The answer is I am a soul, but I'm imprisoned. I'm shackled. I'm stuck. I'm stuck in my bodily reality. And the bodily reality, well, it's like a prison for souls. The soul is able to express itself somewhat, but in a muted fashion. So the soul is calling, the soul is yearning. Very rarely do we actually hear our inner call, our inner voice. Do we recognize our inner yearning or desire? It's like somewhere deep in the subconscious. We know that when we do things which are selfless, when we do things which are spiritual in nature, it makes us feel good. But the path of least resistance is right in front of us. The things that will make us happy in the quick fixes are the things we reach for. And it's difficult, it's challenging to try to live a spiritual life. So this is because the soul is shackled. The soul finds itself in a prison. What is the prison called? This prison, the Alter Rebbe here quotes the Zohar, and he says the guf is called mashcha dechivya, the snake skin. It's a euphemism. When we learn in the story of Genesis about the first sin, who is the prime actor? Not who did the sin, but who caused all the sin? The snake, the serpent. So the serpent represents the notion of that which causes us to depart from our true selves and to embrace that which doesn't make us happy. Like that famous saying, the difference between a rabbi and a salesperson is that the salesperson sells you something you really want, but you don't need. And the rabbi's job is to sell you something you really need, but you don't want. They sell you a new gadget. Great, I need this gadget. No, you don't. You lived just fine without the gadget before. Ah, it's going to be great. This gadget's going to change my life, like all the other gadgets. It'll be in a shelf in 2 weeks. You'll forget about it. And then the next gadget will come out, and this gadget's forgot about. But the things that are really lasting, the things that are really valuable, these are the things nobody wants. Never did anybody say on his deathbed, I wish I had more gadgets in my life. I wish I would have had more fun. Darn it, I missed that skiing trip. This is my great regret in life. What do people regret in life? That they didn't spend more time with their loved ones, that they didn't live more spiritually, they didn't live more selflessly, they didn't live more, they weren't more giving. These are the things people regret. It's a matter of fact. It's a documented matter of fact. You can speak to people, heaven forfend, in this situation. They'll never tell you that their deep regret was they didn't experience some more extraordinary or exotic form of libido or pleasure. So this is the body is much like that snake. And we're basically faced with the situation that Adam and Eve were faced with on a daily basis. On a daily basis, the body, which is our little snake, comes along and says, eat the fruit. Don't be silly. Nobody will care. God doesn't mind either. Anyway, you have the right to do it, and you should enjoy life too, or whatever else the Yetzirah tells us. And oftentimes, sometimes daily, we make the mistake. We fall for the snake. So this is the reality that shackles the body. And the truth is that even somebody who's very righteous, and even somebody who's very holy, and even somebody who's very, very mindful, he also stuck. The neshama is not really free, not the way it was before it was stuck in a body. When his neshama is in a body, it has bodily issues. It's tired, it's frustrated, it's anxious, it's hungry, it's not being respected, it's not being pampered. And these issues eat away at a person. So life then, according to the Alter Rebbe, is about getting out of Mitzrayim, trying to get out of this prison. And you do so on a daily basis. There isn't a one time you break free. No, it's a daily grind. And if you break free in one area of life, so then the Yetzirah concocts the next challenge, the next situation. And this is an ongoing story. That's how we view the Exodus. We view the Exodus by personalizing it, by seeing it not only as a historical narrative, but rather as the spiritual story of each and every single human being. So the body itself darkens the soul, mutes the soul, obscures the soul, and our struggle is to set the soul free. Yetzias Mitzrayim. Okay. So, to take this idea and to develop it a little bit further, there is a pasuk, there is a verse, which is found in the book of Kings. It's a verse that's attributed, the words are attributed to a very, very famous man. You all know him. He was a prophet. Elijah, they called him. He's also called the Tishbite, the Giladi. He has many names in the Torah. So in the beginning of the 17th chapter, Eliyahu, the Tishbite, says to the dwellers of Gilad, he says, Chai Hashem Elokei Yisrael, by the life of God, the Lord of Israel, Asher Amadati Lefanav, that I stood before. The God that I stood before. He doesn't say the God that I stand before, he says the God that I stood before. Now, the commentaries scramble to explain what this means on a very literal level. The Mitzudas David says, Asher Amadati, past tense, Asher Ani Rogil Amid, the God that I stand before on a regular basis, the God that I'm always standing before. Eliyahu HaNavi was always in a state of mindfulness and awareness of God's presence. So he's always standing before God. Radak says something similar. Asher Amadati, Shani Rogil Amid, Lefanav Betfila, the God that I pray before on a regular basis. And on a literal level, that's what it means. But the Zohar has a very different take on this. The Zohar speaks about the circumstances of the soul or the consciousness of the soul prior to its entering the atmosphere. And the Zohar says at that time, Chai Hashem asher omadati lefonov, asher ani omed loktiv. It does not say who I stand before. It says, asher omadati, the God I stood before, past tense. And the Zohar begins to discuss the origin of the soul. And even Elio Hanavi, who was an angel and a supernal creature and being and soul. And the Zohar says, the chol ruchin kadishin deliyelo avdin shlichusa. All holy spirits are in a mission. They're on a mission. V'chulu asyan me'asar chad. They all come from the same place. And then the Zohar talks about differences between grades or shades of tzaddikim and of different neshamas. But the Zohar essentially says all souls come from the same place. Where is that place? That place is the standing before God. All souls once stood before God. So what does this mean, that the souls once stood before God? What is the meaning of standing before God? Souls, the last time I checked, are not corporeal things, so they don't get tired standing, and they don't have to sit and relax. And in the Garden of Eden, when we use verbiage in Torah to describe it, we say, Yoshvim, they're settled. They sit. V'nehnim miziv hashchina, they bask in the glory of God. So if souls in the other world are basking in the glory of God, and they're sitting, as it were, then why does Elio HaNavi describe the neshama prior to its descent into this world as standing before God? So here is an excerpt of a mimer from the Alter Rebbe as well, from the book of Likutei Torah. And I have to tell you that this is discussed a lot in different Hasidic manuscripts. But this is one of the famous places. And it talks about the Mishkan, the tabernacle that the Jewish people built in the desert. And the primary ingredient in the Mishkan, there were a number of different moving parts, if you will. There was the tapestries, there were the various artifacts, there's the holy ark, the menorah, the altar. But the thing that creates the holy space, the sacred space, is of course the boards, the krushim. And these boards of wood are described in the Torah as atzei shitim omdim. They're described as planks of wood, upright, standing planks. In contrast to the log cabins where the logs are laying, they're standing. Really, what difference does it make? Why do the logs have to be upright? It's easier to place the logs one on top of the other. That's the intuitive way to build something with planks. So the Alter Rebbe says that the word omdim is key to understanding the message that God is trying to convey to us. Malachim, angels, nikroim omdim, are called standing. K'mishah Kosov, like it says, srafim omdim. The srafim are standing. And this notion of serafim, which is a certain kind of angel or celestial creature standing, is directly related to the krushim, the boards that are specifically standing, as it is written, Mesharsov, God's ministering angels, kulam omdim berum olam. They all stand in the heights of the universe. And then it says, Umashmi'im beyira. They give ear. They articulate themselves. The angels proverbially sing. They do so with awe. They do so with awe. So they're standing, and then they express themselves with awe. So the Alter Rebbe says, the truth is, Ein Amida Elo Shtika. Amida, which means standing, denotes silence. It denotes standing at attention, standing ready. What does shtika mean? It's not about making noise or not. He says, "Haynu b'chinas bitul ha'atzmus mikol v'kol." That's when a person is standing, ready to receive orders. They're in a state of submission, a state of self-suspension, a state when it's not about me. When I'm standing ready, I'm committed to the mission. When I'm sitting around, you're trying to interrupt me and say, well, come on, why don't you stand up and join us? I don't want to stand up and join you. I'm not interested in doing whatever it is you're doing. But standing from a spiritual verbiage position represents what he calls Bechinas Bitul HaRatzen, the notion that a person's desire is dedicated, a dedicated desire. So my dedicating my desires means Shalai Yehei La'odam Ratzen Acher Zulas HaRatzen LaHashem, that a person is committed to the source, his spiritual source, which we call God. As it says, Ve'im Cholei Chafatzli, I want nothing but you. So this love that we have with God, this relationship we have with God, this connection that we have with God is characterized by absolute perfect submission. You know, like the patriarchs who said, Hineni, here I am. In other words, what the Alter Rebbe says is that the word Amida, standing, represents bittul, represents total self-abnegation. The neshama does not ask what's in it for me. The neshama is interested in God. The neshama doesn't feel itself separate from God. The notion of separation is something that happens when the neshama gets stuck in the body, when he goes to prison. All of a sudden, the neshama is stuck. The neshama wants to be selfless, and it finds itself trapped in a reality that's extremely selfish. A human being is a selfish creature. The most selfish creature in the world is a little baby. He wants to be held. He wants to be coddled. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, kids. Let your parents sleep a little. It's not even possible for the child to hear somebody else's needs. All it knows is its own needs. The intuitive human condition is one of selfishness. We get older, we learn how to be a little more menschlich, to be, you know, more decent, to learn how to share, to learn how to care. These don't come intuitively. A little baby doesn't know how to care or share. He's not bad. He's not evil. He doesn't know of anything else. The human condition, undeveloped, is one of extreme polar selfishness. The soul's nature is one of selflessness. The soul, and this is what Eliyahu HaNavi says, Chai Hashem Elikei Yisrael Asher Amadati Lefanav. Even Eliyahu HaNavi still cares about Eliyahu HaNavi. It's not only about God, it's a little about me too. There's always going to be a what's in it for me. Even the holiest of tzaddikim still has a little me. He needs to have a little me. If he wouldn't have a little me, he wouldn't get credit for serving God. There needs to be a me. If there's no me, who serves God? So God necessarily put us in a body. That's how we can do mitzvahs. And there has to be a self-awareness, separation from God. But Eliyahu HaNavi says that's not who the soul really is. So this is the meaning of the soul being in Mitzrayim. This is the meaning of the soul that finds himself in a situation that's shackled or enslaved. And the soul is not in its natural state. Okay. So this is point one. Point one, I think, has been illustrated, maybe even a little too much. It's very clear that we look at the notion of the soul as being in Mitzrayim, and therefore the exodus, the liberation, the redemption from Mitzrayim should be relevant for us on a personal level. Point number two is that we really, in order to appreciate this, will have to ultimately, A, redefine then what does Egypt mean. What does it mean? And once we define what Yetzia Mitzrayim, what Golos Mitzrayim means, and what redemption from Mitzrayim means, then we can look at the details and see how the details might apply to us. So, if we were to take the story of the Egyptian bondage and slavery out of its literal tense, let's forget the actual slaves and pyramids and suffering and beatings. Let's forget that for a moment. What is the spiritual schematic? What is this really about? I'm not suggesting for a moment it didn't happen. It definitely did happen. But it happened because it's a reflection of a deeper truth. A deeper truth that continues to live on even though the pyramids are no longer, or the slavery is technically a thing of the past. The notion of Yetzias Mitzrayim, there's this idea, something that was playing itself out. What's really going on with Yetzias Mitzrayim? And why is it such an important event? So I'm going to talk to you now in spiritual terms, because everything in Torah can be on many levels of truth, in spiritual terms. When it comes to creation, the Medrash tells us something very interesting. Now, we read the story of Genesis. It's very simple. Bereshis bara elokim, in the beginning, God creates heaven and earth. everything is unformed, and then God forms it, and 6 days go by, whatever that means, however much living God packs into 6 days. And two schools of thought, the school of thought that the 6 days were much more than 6 days, and they're called proverbial 6 days. The Rebbe rejects this. He says that departs from the literal meaning of the scripture. It's as if saying the first two chapters of Genesis are metaphorical, and then it gets literal. But the Rebbe suggests that on a scientific level, it's not impossible to say that you can have millions of years of phenomenon packed into 24 hours. Extraordinary things happen in 24 hours. Each 24 hours reflected what in today's day and age would take a million years, 10 million years, maybe a billion years. Imagine it simply. If a person were to see a volcano that's slowly oozing lava, and every year grows a foot, every year it's documented. We know year after year they're watching this mountain for 1,000 years. It's a mountain that's grown 1,000 years. For 1,000 years we kept records. And the mountain is 2,000 feet high. So the logical conclusion is, how old is the mountain? The mountain is 2,000 years old. Grows a foot every year. Except for one little thing. It's actually 1,001 years old. The eruption of the first year, it grew in 1 year, where it took 1,000 years to grow afterwards. Now, that's very easy for us to understand because we've all seen eruptions, or at least videos of eruptions, or we know about a volcanic eruption. But imagine if there would never have been a volcanic eruption. Imagine nobody ever would have seen that. Nobody could even fathom it. All we could see is live volcanoes that slowly ooze lava. Then it's not unreasonable to say that the mountain is 2,000 years old because we have 1,000 years of records, and there are no 1,000 years of records about anything. We have 1,000 years of records. Year after year, the mountain grows a foot. Because the lava is oozing. But an eruption means that in 1 day, what took 1,000 years to happen could have happened in 1 day. Could have happened in 6 hours. At any rate, that's the story of Genesis, where the world picks up at a certain point, and we see the world as it is. The Medrash comes along and says, Amar Rababa. Rababa says, this is chapter 3 of the Bereishis Rabbah. Pardon me, Amar Rabavo. Melamed. We learn from a number of different verses. If you want to know the specific verses that we learn from, it says, Vayhi Erev. It doesn't say, the Medrash says, it doesn't say, Yehi Erev. It says, Vayhi Erev. It was evening. If the first evening, it should have said, Yehi Erev. Why does it say, Vayhi? So he says, because the narrative of time picks up at a certain point. There's already time prior. Rabavo says, Melamed. God was building worlds and collapsing them. Ad shabara eselu, till he created the world as we know it. In other words, there were many, many, many worlds created prior to ours. Worlds built, worlds collapsed. Worlds built, worlds collapsed, until finally ours emerges. All the mefarshim immediately comment and say, this is what's written elsewhere in the Medrash, that alpayim shana hatoyra koydim loilam, that the Torah comes 2,000 years before the world. So on a literal level, it sounds like time picks itself up not 5,780 years ago, but 7,780 years ago. 2,000 years earlier, and there's 2,000 years of God building worlds and crushing worlds and collapsing worlds, and then at some point, God builds this world. Alpayim shana, says the Eitz Yosef, hayabayna elu masamachrivan. Except for one little problem. It says very clear in many sources that alpayim shana kadma tera le'olam does not mean on the time scale. That bereishis bara elokim, God created space, and before he created space, he created time. Time is sequence. Sequence means you can only be at one moment at once, and that kind of sequence ultimately gives room to the notion of space. So sequence and time gave way to the spatial reality, to space as we know it. And that is to say that when we talk about Torah being 2,000 years higher than this world, it's kadima b'mayla. It means 2,000 levels higher. Whatever you think is the highest level of existence, the highest level of consciousness, the Torah precedes that by the number 2,000. In other words, that this is a non-literal event. And this is the way the vast majority of scholars have learned this medrash, that it is a non-literal event, that there were not physical worlds before, but there were spiritual worlds before. And the spiritual worlds eventually give way to Bereishis Bara Elokim, to the material world, the terrestrial world as we know it. So what were these worlds? What were they about? This, my dear friends, is the Midrashic origin of the Zoharic concept of the world of Tohu that's followed by the world of Tikkun, the world of chaos that eventually gives way to a world of perfection. The previous Rebbe, in a Maimer that he delivered in 1940, says this. He says, the fact that Tohu comes before Tikkun, the fact that the world of chaos precedes the world of order, is because there needs first to be that all that chaos, and that chaos eventually allows us to reach the point where a world of order can be built. The world of order is built on the ruins of the chaos. And he says, this is the meaning of the Lurianic concept that the worlds that collapsed, called Shviras HaKelim, a Kabbalistic principle where worlds blew up or exploded, not to be confused with the scientific theory of the Big Bang, and that world eventually, this is the meaning, he says, incidentally, of the Medrash Rebbe Avo, then this is the meaning of what it says in Zohar, that there was Hakdamas Binyan HaTayu, Vistirasai, the building of a world of chaos, its destruction, V'chdei She'yiyu Binyan HaKelim L'Tikun, so that a world which is comprised of order, of rhyme and reason, of balance, a world in which everything amalgamates, in which there's an ecosystem, where everything kind of works together, everything's working in tandem. In order for it to exist, there had to be a world of chaos first. So our world is built on the foundations of chaos. Why? Because the energy that's contained in the world of chaos is very powerful. And the job of us who are put in this world, which is filled with chaos, is to try to fix all of that damage by extracting the sparks and bringing them home. And this is the Lurianic concept of Tikkun Olam, which has been perverted and twisted beyond recognition, but it basically means that all of physical existence has embedded within it sparks of spiritual energy that come from a loftier and a higher universe. And it's embedded in our world and enables our world even to exist on some level. And it is supposed to be fixed and rectified by us when we behave appropriately. And that's our mission. The Rebbe even goes so far as to say that just as we describe the neshama living in a very, very lofty state, being put into a prison-like state, and now it has to transcend that prison, that the reason the neshama is created and put into that situation is a perfect parallel of the world of chaos that's invested into a world of order. And now our job is to fix all that. So Yetzias Mitzrayim means that we have to get out of Mitzrayim. The meaning of leaving Mitzrayim behind means to be able to take the sparks home. What does this mean? In a Maimer and Torah, in this week's Torah portion, the Alter Rebbe says that the description of the Jewish peoples leaving Egypt is Vayinatzlu es Mitzrayim. They emptied Egypt. The Gemara in Maseches Pesachim says, She'aso kimitzula she'ein badogim, that Egypt became like a net that was fleeced of its fish. So you know the fishermen put up nets when the high tide is going to come in, and then when the high tide pulls out, lots of fish get stuck in the net. And then the fishermen harvest the net. So there's this notion that they emptied Mitzrayim. On a literal level, it means they emptied Egypt of its wealth. On a deeper level, in the writings of Luriana Kabbalah, it says, Shelokdu kol hanitzutzin shenoflu b'shvira aleihem, that they took all the sparks of holiness that had been embedded in that part of the world. V'nisroiknu Mitzrayim, Egypt was emptied of its spiritual energy until nisharu kimtzula, it was left emptied or fleeced. And it's brought down in the writings of the Arizal that this is the reason that the Torah prohibits a Jew from going back to live in Egypt, because there's no purpose in living in Egypt. The purpose of life in a terrestrial way is to find the sparks. No sparks left. The sparks were taken. So we finished Mitzrayim, and now the job is to find the sparks in the rest of the world. So why did Jews live in Mitzrayim? There were times Jewish people had no choice. They had no choice because they faced certain death or starvation, and it's not for us to judge them. But the reality is that an enormous part of our mission is to find those sparks. It's also to live in a certain way as God asks us to. But if you're doing that in Mitzrayim, you're missing a major part of the mission. You may be living as Hashem wants you to, and that's a good thing, but you're not finding sparks anymore. You're not able to extrapolate sparks because they've all been taken out. The question is, how do we get out of Mitzrayim? How do we get out of this, the reality that seems to shackle us, inhibit us, disable us? How did they get out of Mitzrayim then? So the next point I'm going to make is that we've already established the notion that the Exodus can and should be personalized. We established the notion that it's a description of our personal spiritual journey. We established the notion that the notion even of Mitzrayim of old also has what we would call a spiritual schematic about sparks, about redemption. So now we're going to look at the specifics of how we got out of Mitzrayim. And by analyzing some of those specifics, we're going to realize or have an appreciation of how they left Mitzrayim then and how we can leave our Mitzrayim today. And that will teach us how to look at life differently and be a lot happier. So let's go to the very beginning. I don't mean the beginning of the story. I mean the beginning of the liberation, the beginning of the Exodus. When does it start? When do they start to leave Mitzrayim? Not on the night of Pesach. They don't start to leave Mitzrayim when we open the book of Exodus and we hear a story about a nation that's being enslaved. They don't start to leave Egypt when we hear a story of people who are forced to kill babies, even when these brave women defy those orders. We don't start to leave Egypt when Moses is miraculously born and saved. We don't start to leave Egypt when Moses meets the burning bush. When do we start to leave Egypt? We start to leave Egypt at the very end of chapter 3, the beginning of chapter 4, pardon me, of chapter 7 of the book of Exodus, where in chapter 7, God says to Moses, all right, it's time to go. I'm going to send you in. You're going in now. And there's going to be amazing, marvelous wonders happening. And you'll see the Pharaoh won't listen. And that's because I want all of these things to happen. And the end game is the Exodus. So we could argue that what brings about the Exodus? The plagues, the marvels, the miracles and the wonders. And what is the purpose then of miracles and wonders? So in chapter 7, verse 5, the Torah says this. V'yodu Mitzrayim, after describing how the Pharaoh will not listen, and I will place my miracles in the land of Egypt, and I will judge them. Verse 5 says, V'yodu Mitzrayim ki ani Hashem. Egypt will know that I am God. Bintoisi es yodi, when God anthropomorphically lifts his hand al Mitzrayim, V'hoitzeisi es b'nei Yisrael mitoicham, and I take the Israelites out from amongst them. So Egypt will know, and that will enable the Exodus. Egypt will know. What are we talking about when we say Egypt will know? Rashbam, the famous grandson of Rashi, says Egypt refused to recognize a God that could not be seen, felt, or touched. When the Pharaoh was approached by Moses, who said, God sent me, what was Pharaoh's response? God? Never heard of him. Leodaiti es havaya. I don't know who this God is. I have a pantheon of gods, but this God you're talking about, I don't know. He's not on my Rolodex. So Rashbam says, you will know him. You will find out who is really the creator. You will find out who's in charge of reality. The Ibn Ezra says, it's not going to be Mitzrayim. The world will find out. Egypt, there's nothing left of Egypt. All of Egypt's talent is finished. By the time the Reed Sea sinks everybody, there's nobody left. He says it's the rest of the world that are going to know that God took the Israelites out of Egypt. The Alter Rebbe has a very, very original interpretation of this business of taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim through the concept of the Makkos. Listen carefully. Let's go back to the subject we talked about. Let's go back to the idea that Egypt represents the sparks that have to be redeemed. That's really the big scheme. The big scheme of things is there are sparks, and the sparks have to be redeemed. And when we leave Mitzrayim, we go with those sparks. So what's holding the sparks back? The answer is that the sparks are being concealed. If the sparks were once part of God, what's holding them back? So the answer is the sparks, Yordu Hanitzutzin, the sparks descended, and v'nislabshu b'toich haklipos, they went into what's called the husks. The husks is a euphemism. It means things which do not have intrinsic value, things which are only a means to an end. The husk simply protects the fruit. And the moment you got the fruit, you throw the peel away. It's packaging. Packaging was not meant to be consumed. Packaging was not meant to be kept. Packaging was meant to deliver the item. It has a purpose. And when its purpose comes to an end, it is folded and collapsed. That's called klipa, because God created two parts of his world, a part of his world which was destined to be that which houses his presence, and the part of the world which is going to bring us to the housing of his presence. And once it brings us, then we're done with it. Serves a purpose, then we discard it. So all evil, all that which is unholy and unkosher, all that which cannot be brought into tandem with serving God will be discarded. That's the meaning of when Mashiach comes, all the klipa is gone. Klipa is a peel. Klipa is a packaging. We get the fruit, we got there, it's tossed. So the problem is that the sparks are in the peel. And because they're in the peel, the only way to get the spark out is by breaking the shell. And the Alter Rebbe says, this is kemoshel, he says, the metaphor I want to offer you is on the klipa shehi chayfefes umakefes ala pri. This is like the shell which surrounds and entombs the nut. Hakonas b'teicha, which is held inside it. The nut which is concealed by it. Kemoshel klipa se'egez, like the shell of a nut. Ve'ein terufa, there's no solution. Lehoitzi apri, to get the nut out. Kiim al yedei shviras hakli, the nutcracker. You have to crack the nuts. You crack the nuts, you get the nuts. You don't crack the shells, you don't get the nuts. Don't try to eat walnuts without cracking the shell. It's not going to work. You can't even chew on sunflower seeds unless you first crack the shell. The kach kedei lehoitzi nitzutzei hakdusha, in order to take these sparks of holiness, hamastidim aleihem, that are concealing them, tzarech lias shvira saklipa. The shell has to be cracked. The shell has to be pulverized. The shell has to be broken. And this is, he says, the idea of the oisis umaisim. This is the marvels. This is the wonders. Egypt represented this big klipa, this force that denied the presence of God, this force of evil that enslaved people, murdered people, destroyed people, an evil force. And the only way for the sparks to come out is for the evil force to be crushed and broken. Was not redeemable. You couldn't turn it around. The only way to free people who languished under communism was to crush communism. Communism couldn't be redeemed. Nazism couldn't be redeemed. You couldn't negotiate with a Nazi. The only way was to crush the regime. Crush the regime, you free the people. You cannot negotiate with Iran. Its government is monstrous. They are the worst offenders of human rights in the world today. The greatest exporters of murder and mayhem and terrorism. The people are around, lots of good people there. They all languish under this horrible force. The only one way for them to be freed. Crush the evil. That's how you get the sparks out. Break the shell, you save the nut. You redeem the nut. Now there's different kinds of klipa. Sometimes it's klipa that can be turned around. Sometimes we have a peel which can actually be made edible. Like people make this orange peel with chocolate. Or the skin of the chicken, which doesn't have to be discarded, you can actually, or the certain fish, which you can actually eat the skin. So that's called klipas noga. That's called a shell of light. Shells of light don't have to be broken. Shells of light simply have to be developed. But then there are shells. The only way you can get the nut is by breaking the shell. There is no other way. Egypt could not have been negotiated with. The Pharaoh was not in the position to negotiate. This was a monster who bathed in the blood of babies. You can't negotiate with that. He had to be destroyed. His government had to be dismantled. His power had to be broken. When his power was broken, then the sparks could be released. Now, the Rebbe says an amazing thing. He says, everybody reads the word of the Yodu Mitzrayim Ki Ani Hashem, Egypt will know. Now, the Rebbe says, who said it means to know? It means to break. He said, really? Where does it say that? The answer, right in the scripture. In the book of Judges, there's a story of Gideon. And he comes to a place called Sukkot. And he's not very happy with the people. And he says, he takes the elders of the city and he teaches them a lesson. It says, V'yoida bahem es anche Sukkot. He'll explain things to the people of Sukkot, which is translated as V'yoida, Targum Yonison. Yonison renders it, V'tovar. V'tovar means, V'tavar means to break the people. These are the people who rebelled. These are the people who have to be taught a lesson. Rahamitzudas David says, Im hakoitzim haya miyasram umeshabram. With the thorns, he was punishing them. He was breaking them. He broke these people. In other words, the word v'yoda, as Radak says, is l'shen shvira. It comes to the terminology of breaking. And he says, haydiya lehem pisham. He explained to them what they did wrong. He broke them. Like sometimes you have people who are very arrogant and then they get broken. When you break them, then you can negotiate. Then you can talk. But first they have to be broken. The Alter Rebbe suggests that the notion of Yodu Mitzrayim, and I quote, is Miloshoin Shavira. Comes from the terminology of being broken. And he says this is exactly what I was telling you earlier about the idea of the sparks in the shell. And the only way to get the nut is to break the nutshell. The thing is that the klipa is very powerful. God endows it with this power. And the klipa cannot always be turned around. A lot of this klipa is pure evil. If you want to get the food out, you have to rip the packaging. You have to throw it away. If you don't rip the packaging and throw it away, you're not going to be able to get the food out. So this is the notion, how do we get out of Mitzrayim? If we understand the schematic of the slavery and the liberation from a spiritual perspective. We're talking here about sparks that were embedded that had to be released. That could only happen when the nut was cracked, when the shell, when the klipa was broken. Just like we understand literally that the only way that the Jewish people could emerge as a nation is if the superpower that enslaved them would be broken. And when that government was entirely pulverized and dismantled, then we could leave free as a nation. And as long as they were left in power, we weren't free. And the proof of the pudding was, as long as there was some power left, they pursued us. And it's only at the end of the 7 days when they drown in the Reed Sea, and then Egypt of the time is gone forever, then we are actually a free people. Then we can go to serve God. Because these were a people who, even when they let us go, it was a temporary thing. And they believed it was their right to enslave us. And they believed it was their right to kill us. It was their God-given right. Can't negotiate with that. It's got to be crushed. That's the meaning of leaving Mitzrayim. So now let's take this whole spiritual schematic, this idea that going out of Mitzrayim in spiritual terms means releasing sparks. And it means that in order to get the sparks out, that you have to crush the shell. And now let's remind ourselves that we've made a point earlier of saying that every one of us is in Mitzrayim. And the only way for us to get out of Mitzrayim is for us to break the shell. So the idea actually becomes very, very simple. There's a Gemara that says, Ein adam oymid al dvar halacha, ela im kein nichshobay. The only way that you really learn a halacha right is if first you slipped, tripped, and made a mistake. The best lessons in life are the lessons that are learned from the mistakes we make. I once heard that Bill Gates only hires CEOs who went bankrupt once. I don't know if it's true, but it might make sense. If you think back in life, there have been a lot of painful circumstances we all went through. And very, very often, the pain we felt, if we were smart enough to bounce back and learn the lessons of it, made us a better person. Just have to look back. Hindsight is 20/20. When you look back at the course of life, the most powerful lessons that you learned in your youth came when you learned how to ride a bicycle by falling off the bike and skinning your knee. If you never fell off the bike, you never learned how to do it. If you never fell off your ice skates or your roller skates, you still don't know how to ice skate or roller skate. If the child was kept wrapped with in down blankets and never allowed the freedom to make mistakes, then at the end of the day, the child was suffocated. Sometimes we need to make our mistakes, and the mistakes hurt, and they're painful, but they enable us to grow. In other words, we're going to talk all the questions later, Professor. In other words, please hold your thought. In other words, the notion of Yetzia Mimitzrayim means, on a spiritual level for us, that we have to see painful circumstances and difficult circumstances and things that happen in the way we wouldn't like, we have to see these as opportunities to break out of our klipa. This is how we can free our soul. Sometimes the only way to learn a lesson is by falling off the bike. Sometimes the only way we're actually going to be able to set our soul free is by dealing with a set of circumstances that we didn't ask for, that we didn't want. Now, hindsight that's 20/20 does nothing for you unless you use what you learned in the past to project into the future. That is to say, here is the simple way we can all make our lives better. You have a painful set of circumstances. The person is in a situation where he didn't want to be. So either I can become despondent, depressed, angry, frustrated, anxious, or I can ask myself, there's a lesson to be learned. There's a moment of freedom that this is giving me. How am I going to do that? There's a silly story that illustrates this. I'm sure I shared it many times. They say it's a real story of a fellow who is an owner of a whole chain of stores. And the story goes that he was, in the beginning, when he first came after the war, he needed a job. He became a shamus in a shul. He was helping out in a shul. That's all he knew what to do. He had no education, barely spoke English. And so there was a wedding in the shul, and they called him over to be a witness on the ketubah. He said, sign your name. He said, I don't know how to sign in English. You don't know how to sign your name? The president went AP, went crazy. He says, I'm not having a shamus in my shul who doesn't write English, who writes an X. And he forced the rabbi to fire the shamus. The shamus now is out of a job. So what did he do? He had to make a living. So somehow he got some kind of borrowed a push cart, and he started selling the dry goods from his push cart, became a peddler, and then he had some success, eventually bought his own push cart, and eventually from being a peddler, bought a store, and one store turned into numerous stores and eventually a whole franchise. And the story goes that many years later, he's taking an enormous loan from the bank to grow the business exponentially, and he's told to sign his name, and he makes an X. And the banker says, I beg your pardon? You don't know how to sign your name? The guy said, listen, I was a refugee. I was in the camps. I never learned English. This is what I can do. And the fellow says, wow. Imagine what you would have been able to do if you could sign your name. He says, yep, I'd be a shamus in a shul. So a painful story, a painful situation, actually became liberating. The only way he could liberate his ambition was when he didn't have those circumstances anymore. As long as he had a cushion, as long as he had a cocoon, he wasn't going to be able to break out of it. Let's talk about this on a very simple level that everybody can understand, everybody can relate to. You're a kid. We're all in school, in elementary school. You figured out your classroom. You knew how to work the teacher. You figured everything out. And then just when you're getting comfortable in second grade ended, now you're in third grade. And now everything changes. And you're not comfortable again. And then when you finally get comfortable in third grade, it happened to you again in fourth grade and fifth grade. And then when you left middle school, it was a terrible thing. You had left elementary school, went to middle school. And then from middle school, you went to high school. And from high school, you went to university. And at each stage, there was deep uncomfortability. Why? because you had to let go of your comfort zone and be in a new reality. And that could be painful. And that could be uncomfortable. And sometimes it can break us. But that breakage allows for a release of inner faculty, of inner talent, of inner energy that otherwise would never have made its way out. There's a silly story, but still, it's by Dr. Tversky. Abraham J. Tversky tells the story, and I think it illustrates this point. He talks about pain as a launching pad for growth. And he tells the story of being in a dentist's office and not having what to do. I guess it was before the days of iPhones. And so he picked up a magazine, and the magazine had an article about lobsters. The way he tells the story, I don't really care about lobsters. I don't eat lobsters. What do I care about lobsters? But that's the article. I started reading the article. And the article is talking about the life of a lobster. And the life of a lobster, he lives in a hard shell. And at some point, the hard shell starts getting really tight. It gets tighter and tighter until he can't take it anymore. The pain is excruciating. So the lobster throws the shell off, and then he goes and hides under a rock until he can grow a new shell. And then he does this several times over the course of his life if he doesn't get caught. He keeps throwing off the old shell, which is his protective armor, and growing a new shell so that he's able to be comfortable. Rabbi Tversky says, I thought to myself, if the lobster would be a person, he would simply go to the doctor and he would get painkillers and he wouldn't grow. He wouldn't let go, because we don't like to let go of our comfort zone. We like to be comfortable. That's the path of least resistance. But if we don't leave our comfort zone, we never grow. This is the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is the story of the Exodus. This is the story of our Golus, where we're stuck in a bodily reality. The soul is shackled, but ultimately we as people are shackled. And the only way we can experience real growth is sometimes by having to let go of a circumstance that was once comfortable. Sometimes we let go, and sometimes it happens to us. We're not always in control. In fact, we're very rarely in control. We're never in control. What we are in control is not what's going to happen, but we are in control of how we react. That's the meaning of seeing beyond. Having a liberated perspective means to know that when something happens that seems to make us collapse, we should know that this, in fact, is a segue into new growth. This is a geula. It's a redemption. It's how we're going to leave yesterday behind and enter into a glorious new tomorrow. And that's b'chol yom v'yom, which means continuously. That's the way we go through life. And you don't have to wait for challenging circumstances. Sometimes it's best to challenge yourself. Do things which are comfortably uncomfortable. People say to Rabbi, I'm not comfortable doing this. I said, great, then it's time to do it. It's not who I am yet. If we always do things which come easily and comfortably, we never grow. Yetziah Mimitzrayim really has to become a way of life. And as long as we keep smashing the shells, the fruits or the sparks get set free, and eventually, hopefully very soon and in our time, the final sparks are released, and this results in a whole new world with the coming of Mashiach. B'mheira u'b'yameinu. Yes, yes, Professor.
What you just described, the necessity to